Hey, you talk a lot about vulnerabilities and you have to worry about protecting your enterprise, but I've got a couple of people on the show coming up that are going to give you some invaluable insights, so stick around. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and I have with me Patrick Garrity. Say hello, Patrick.
So.
And Todd Beardsley. And Patrick is the security researcher with VulnCheck. And Todd, as you said, you are the Dick Cheney of Run Zero, the vice president of security research. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, no politics here. This is how we managed to stay on the air for almost 5 years. We just don't go there. But in any case, welcome to the show. Glad to have you. And for a little bit of background, because, of course, I'm looking here at Patrick and he got like a bazillion skateboards in the back. But tell me a little bit about yourself, the background, how you got to where you are and what you're doing these days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I've always been a tinkerer, but worked in security, starting at Duo Security back in 2012, so a little over a decade, and have just been building, helping scaling cybersecurity companies and working on different problems. And then more recently, over the last couple of years, like spent a lot of time in vulnerabilities and exploitation and transitioned into a research role. So, and then, yeah, I love to skateboard. I was skateboarding last night. I skateboard almost every day, sometimes multiple times a day. So. That's my
hobby. Alrighty. That works. And that's something I never got into when I was younger. And probably as a result, I'm not sure my age is a good idea to get started. I'd have to go out there looking like perhaps
to the start skate.
Covered with a helmet and gloves and knee pads and then shoulder pads and things like that. And I'm still pretty sure I
don't remember it. Gear is cool.
Yeah,
pretty cool. High wearing gear.
Right. So, Todd, other than jumping out of airplanes without a parachute, what's your fun hobby?
Well, I'll get to that. But I have been a hacker criminal type for most of my life. I would say I started when I was about 12 or 13 in the late 20th century, and I ran a text file BBS and I distributed FRAC then, and it just kind of got out of hand from there. So I've always been interested in like how computers work and specifically how networks work. Like I cared a lot about the telephone network, right? I was a phone freak and I got into network engineering. It's all super long and boring. Highlights are I was the technical manager for Metasploit for a number of years. I've written an exploit or two. And I was at CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security of the United States government. And right now I'm at, like you said, I'm at Run Zero, and I am Patrick's mortal enemy because, as we all know from the movie Hackers, the bad guys skateboard, the good guys roller skate.
Why own roller skate?
And I do roller skate. I am passable at it. One day I will learn how to go backwards.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't roller skate. Building that one skate.
Yes.
All righty. So we can get you guys in formation, and then you'll be able to go out there and do that stuff. Well, hey, let's talk about vulnerabilities and things like that. I mean, they've been around ever since we started inventing computers. It's a matter of saying, hey, you know, what's a vulnerability? It's basically something that the designer of a system didn't take into account when he or she built it, right? And we've got vulnerabilities in cars. You start early on, we didn't have seatbelts. Then it turned out that if you stop fast or you hit something, you know, you tend to go through the windshield. So, yeah, that's a vulnerability relative to passenger safety. Eventually, someone comes up with a patch. Whoa, seatbelt.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, like, you know, my friend Bob Lord will often talk about auto safety in the context of vulnerability disclosure and patching and, you know, unsafe at any speed is like, you know, the book about like auto safety. Patrick, I know that you are Detroit adjacent. So you probably do have
Motor City
10W40 like in your blood. But like, it's interesting you bring up seatbelts because like that was a fight right? Like that was a multi-year fight. It required government regulation for it to happen. And there was still a culture, there was like a car culture where like you don't wear a seatbelt unless like you're a race car driver. And and like now my kids go bananas if someone's not wearing a seatbelt and you're in a parking lot. They're like, what are you doing? That's insane. And so like it is possible to change culture, right? Like I think is the point there. As possible to be through a culture of vulnerability disclosure and patching and just recognizing that software is unsafe generally, and we have to do things to make it safe and secure.
Well, you remember the old Steve McQueen movie Bullet, where they're just facing around, and just before they get ready for the final crazy race scene, you see the guy click a seatbelt. Just a lap belt. It's like, okay, now it's going to get serious. Up till now,
that's right. Up till
San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no one's taking it too seriously. We're only doing like 50 or 60 or whatever.
hey, I might. So this year I broke my arm and I would never wear wrist guards. I will wear a wrist guard every day I skate for the rest of my life now.
I have some really dope safety gear that I wear.
There is a pain.
Yeah. For roller skating, I have taken to like construction safety equipment because it looks cooler. You know, like the roller skating stuff tends to be like really brightly colored, and that's fine. And like, that's, you know, if that's your thing, that's great. But I like the, you know, the matte black, the khaki, the like post-apocalyptic roller skating look is
nice
for me.
But yeah, I think tying this back to like the discussion, right, of what we're talking is like, yeah, I think what we're experiencing with some of these software vendors is like they're getting hit with exploitation from threat actors continually. So now it's like, oh, we actually have to take this software security and vulnerability thing a lot more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why you have like upwards of 420 nice CVE numbering authorities out there. Like Volcheck is one. Run Zero sadly is not one yet, but working on it. Don't worry about it.
So you actually bring up an interesting question. I want to dive into it before I forget it and my aging brain here. So when you talk about the CVE and a numbering authority, what we look at these things is we say, okay, fine, here's, you know, you expect somebody to come out. It's a brand new, it's January 1st. So I'm going to expect, you know, CVE number one, number two, number three. Also like 18,433. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's like from 2 years ago. I mean, what is these things? They're like somebody goes to the meat counter at the grocery store, grabs a whole bunch of these little numbers and sticks them in their pocket and then uses them later.
I think I'll let Patrick take this one. It's Andrew, this is sort of a reservation border.
Yeah, we have a few different recent experiences. So, we grabbed you can reserve CVEs, right? And then there's when you publish it date, and then there's a year in the CVE identifier. So those are like very different things.
Those are three points in time.
Yeah, 3 points in time. And so some people are like, oh, you published this vulnerability, but it's CVE 2007. The reason why we do that is because that's when the vulnerability was disclosed. It's just that nobody made an identifier for it.
Right.
Which is a way to do it.
Yeah, and some people don't. Originally, I think when we were starting to do some of our more recent work, we were putting them all as 2025, and someone came along and said, why not use the year that it was actually published? That's my vulnerability, right? So I don't know if
they get these things in your sock drawer just in case you need them 5 years later, or...
So generally, no. So the rules on CVE, the year part of CVE, we actually spent just an enormous amount of expensive time on this. and we ended up with like a bunch of shoulds and mays in the rules. Like CVEs should reflect the year that they were discovered or disclosed or published. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big pile of ores. Because CVE now ships in a nice little JSON format with bunches of metadata, if you want to do things like if you want to ask the question of how many CVEs were there issued in 2022, you have to look at the JSON data with the date published. Okay. which is real high up, right? So like that's the one to look at. A lot of people, especially students writing papers, will look at the year part and foolishly believe the year part means the year that they think it is, right?
I wonder if ChatGPT makes the same mistake when you first tell it to think.
So I did mention students. ChatGPT is the level of the I don't want to do the homework student. And so about that level, which is fine. Hey, man, that is impressive as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if I mentioned this. I'm old. And ChatGPT is incredible. Amazing. It's an incredible chatbot. But yeah, it will fall over on these kinds of details, especially when it comes to like numbering things and precision. ChatGPT is not particularly good at being precise.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we kind of center.
Yeah, we're going to wander all over the place. Yeah.
So we paid sometimes you put in a number that doesn't exist and it will tell you about the vulnerability, even though it doesn't exist type of thing.
If you ask ChatGPT about MS-17-010, you will get answers about MS-17-010. If you ask it about MS-17-011, you will get answers about MS-17-010 because there's more in the training data on that one.
Yeah, that's true. It's going to kind of pick because, you know, we've talked about this before. At least I've talked about in other shows when you have a generative pre-trained transformer. There's your 500 Jeopardy question for what does GPT stand for. But you're right. It's just going to pick the most common association that you see. So when you see peanut, you're going to get peanut butter. You're not going to get peanut squirrel or something like that. Eventually, you'll get peanut the squirrel up in New York, but that's way down on the food chain, so to speak. So we've got CVEs, and we've got a process that's been around for a number of years where you could go ahead and number them. And that got rid of an awful lot of the arbitrariness. If you remember back in the 90s where someone would say, oh, this is code red. Why is it code red? That's what I was drinking when I was going ahead and I discovered it. And the same thing would be named different things by different vendors. Yeah. So that really kind of at least brought
us. That's similar how we deal with threat actors today. Like,
yeah,
we've got exactly. Sources for whatever Salt Typhoon is.
Yeah, I want to know who gets to pick their APT number. It's like, I want to be APT 1337. Where do I apply for that? I'm so you jump ahead and like, I'm going to reserve that number.
Who does the APT numbers? Is it CrowdStrike?
Because Mandiant did APT.
No, numbers are more Mandiant or
Mandiant?
The APT numbers. CrowdStrike likes to use like bear animals. And then there's like a whole initiative where like Microsoft was using like weather, I think.
Yeah.
And then, like, now they're trying to work together with a common framework, but yeah, still using their...
They should call the CVE program, we've dealt with this.
Yeah. Then you had elements and things like that, so you would have something in a time.
Yeah, we had, like, the noblinium at one point.
Yeah, then you start running out.
I need to look up the aliases, because I think, like, I have all the data. We map it, and... Like, my assumption is, like, I did Cozy Bear, and that had, like, 20 aliases, you know, 20 different names, so.
I mean, like the Hafnian group. I mean, how would you like to be the Helium group?
Because everybody has to talk like this, though.
It's a bunch of mice.
They're all very small.
Hafnium, I think, is called Stone Panda by CrowdStrike. Yeah, I was just, yeah. Like, it's
yeah, I think Bear was for Russia, Panda was for China, and you know, different countries had different associated animals and things like that. I think you're an Indian. The Canadian groups were a moose, and a bigger fashion to be.
It's funny. But, on that note, right? I think the like you have the identifiers, right, and then you have the activity of things exploiting or taking advantage of those vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, like that's one of the leaps I spend a lot of time on, right? Is there's identifying the vulnerability and then there's identifying and disclosing exploitation, which is more oriented around threat, and then threat actor naturally attribution to that is a logical next step.
Yeah.
So
I consider threat actor attribution to be way too hard.
Yeah, it is
full of guesses, and I don't bother because in most now some places are different, right? Some sites actually care who's attacking them, but in most cases, in most enterprises, who's attacking you doesn't really change like your strategy on defense. And so, like practically speaking, if China is attacking or an advanced persistent team is attacking me, my response is the same, right? I am going to patch. I'm going to, you know, isolate. I'm going to configure correctly. You know, I'm going to do all the kind of normal things to, you know, bottle up, contain, you know, analyze, all that other stuff, regardless of who's doing it. So I've never really super cared about attribution. Now, when I was at CISA, I had to care a lot more. You know, Workaday, CISOs, generally, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter at all.
Well, it's an interesting thought, because if your attribution points to a national threat actor versus some kid in mom's basement in Iowa, I would think that your level of concern about how, you know, what's their motivation, how deep are they going to go, and where do they resource, would be useful. But you can probably infer that based upon the techniques, I would think.
Yeah, whatever they're doing. I mean, it can be useful in some cases to know, like, oh, this is Iran, because I believe it's Iran, I can expect this kind of activity. Like, I might have a certain set of tools, techniques, and practices. Or TTPs, that is going to be in use, something I can look for, right? So like certain patterns will show up with certain threat actors. But like, here's the thing, they're all spies and they're all trained espionage agents and they know how to pretend to be each other. I had an entire DEF CON talk of how to pretend to be Chinese. And when you're doing something untoward, right? Because if you pretend to be Chinese, and someone picks up on that, then, oh, okay, well, they're just going to refer it to the FBI and they're just going to not even bother investigating me. And I'm not going to get arrested because I live in Iowa, right? Like, that is a technique that criminals use for sure. Other espionage agents use for sure. And the whole point of the DEF CON talk is like, maybe don't believe everything you see because it's super easy. It generally is very easy to pretend to be one of the known threat actors.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm doing a talk in October in Ireland looking at deception. And specifically, it's kind of advanced now. It's a conference there that I spoke at the last 3 years. This will be the fourth year looking at the Russian and Ukrainian cyber war. And it was interesting because kind of a little diversion here, but the call for papers was like in March of 2022. Like, this thing just happened 2 weeks ago, and it may or may not keep going. But I'm going to think that maybe it's going to keep going. Unfortunately, we're shot out of the fourth year. And like, I want to stop talking about all this stuff. So what I really want to look at is probably the longer term impact, because what we've seen, whether it's kinetic, going with drones, going with UAVs, things like that, going with other types of approach now in the cyber world, where we have seen a lot of escalation, because in warfare, there's a lot of innovation because, well, your lives depend upon it. And then you're a little bit more motivated to come up with something instead of saying, yeah, it's 4:30. Let's go out and go skateboarding or roller skating. It's like, let's keep going because we could be
dead. War is hell. Is a terrible, terrible, terrible event. It's top three worst, right, for humans. But that said, you get a lot of innovation happening, like the world before World War One and the world after World War One. We're different worlds. After World War Two, we're different worlds, and I think we're seeing that effect now in cyberspace because we have active participants in Ukraine and Russia. We have active participants in Israel and Gaza. We have like just kind of the simmering activity that's happening all of the time, sourced from Iran, North Korea, China, etc. And what's happening, which is
Russia?
No, I opened with Russia. I said Russia and Ukraine. And how dare you, sir? Sorry, my Patreon.
You just said three on that, I thought.
One, two, and five, three, sir.
And what we see is a degradation of norms is the thing I've been concerned about, right? Like, it was used to be weird when like spies were also hackers. It was exotic, and people would do it, and then they would get caught, and then it would be like a whole song and dance of like, oh, like these are just criminals. They are not state sponsored. They are just criminals, right? Like, it would be something like that. Whereas today, you don't see a ton. You don't see as vociferous a defense or an excuse for folks when they get caught. And so, like, it is getting a little more wild out there. And I think you will probably see that in the data, where you can see like more. It's not just that like the software is getting worse, or there's more vulnerabilities, or there's more people looking at vulnerabilities. Like, all of these things are true. But I think what's driving the exploitation traffic is the fact that like gloves are off. And if you want to like train on how to hack and you want to be a good pen tester and you live in the US, hack China, right? Because you're never going to get extradited. it's already illegal, but like the FBI is not gonna come after you. Now, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I don't know. I'm not a U.S. government employee.
It's
not legal advice, but but like this is the world we live in, where like it is presumed, like we've always kind of said, like the internet is a hostile network, but it is much more hostile today than it was even 5 years ago.
We've come a long way. I mean, if you go back to April 1st, 2001, and that was when it was a Navy EP-3 collided with a Chinese J-8.
Sure.
Off of, you know, Hainan. And then the J pilot went down into the drink. American pilot's like, I'm damaged. This plane won't stay in the air. I got to land it. So can you imagine this 28-year-old American pilot radioing into the Chinese that we've been spying on, by the way, and said, I'm going to land on your runway. And like, No, you're not. He says, yes, I am. Here I come. And they went. Well, what happened subsequently to that was what we called the Great Patriotic Hacker Wars, where prior to that in China, if you got caught hacking, they would execute you, then bill your family for the cost of the bullet. I just kind of add a little bit of a nastiness to the end of it. And after that, they're like, well, Americans, yeah, go for it. Well, Americans would hack back. And so across the Pacific that summer at 9600 baud or whatever we were calling
it. 2008 feet of
the end of your, yeah. The 28-8 probably. But that began kind of those early concept of, you know, international rather than intranational, because intranational, you're subject to your own local law enforcement, your laws, regulations, etc. Now, again, as we say, kids, don't try this at home. Don't just go ahead and say, hey, let me go use on it because I need to practice. We have cyber ranges. We have all kinds of great tools.
Definitely
perfect your skills.
Hack in the box is a thing. There's tons of puzzles out there that like help. You don't need to go after live targets.
But there are people who are authorized to go after live targets, and those, they have what they call the authority. So typically if you're going to be working offensive warfare, like at a little fort up in Maryland, then what they'll do is the generals go to war with their lawyers now. It's not so much, hey, let's go ahead and put a warhead on a forehead. They turn over and they say, counselor, do I have the authorities? You know, Title 10, Title 50, Title 30, whatever it happens to be, okay, you can do that. And then the Booz Allen consultant loads up the package and says, General, please press the enter key. Because the Booz Allen consultant can't lodge it, but the general has the authorities. And so it's kind of a strange delegation of duties in that type when you get into lawful offensive warfare. Well,
I think the moral of the story here is that, like, the internet's a dangerous place, right? And it takes, companies like Volchak and like RenZero and like all of the others, right, that are doing what we can to, like, stave off attackers and give good advice and be able to articulate, like, what is a vulnerability and what does your vulnerability profile look like? What's your exposure? And, like, how about all your configurations? Like, let's talk about that. Because it's important to know that, like, attackers, generally speaking, given all the chances, we don't see attackers using exploits too often as initial access vectors. The last round, I'm excited to see the next round, but like the last round of reporting, right? Like the Mandiant report, the Verizon report, all that, all breathlessly reported. It's like, hey, initial access vector exploits are up by like 15%. It's like, cool. So up by 15%. And now it's a total of 20%. So what you're telling me is that you're very excited that it's almost 1 in 5. And that I thought was pretty funny, which tells me 80% of the time they don't, right? 80% of the time, initial access is going to be like, click on my bad email, come to my watering hole and like, give me your password.
That's the worst.
And your password is password one, of course. And so like, it's all these like kind of rinky dink, easy stuff. And it's, as they are very fond of saying on your competitor podcast, Risky Business, as they're very fond of saying, like, if it works, it's not dumb. Yeah. And that tends to work. You don't need an exotic exploit when you just have a buffet of exposure to choose from.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we also look at the silicon, but you're right, the carbon's a whole lot easier to hack. And
it tends to be.
I mean, I'm doing a tabletop exercise for a client, and it's basically a scenario where they end up remote hiring somebody, and it turns out that they happen to be from DPRK. Not that we've ever heard that before, but we've been developing the scenario now for a number of months. In the meantime, maybe who knows, maybe it's actually happened and then realized.
Oh, it definitely is happening.
It's going to get ahead of the thing. I'm thinking like, hey, this is something that could happen, but because of the long development time, it's like, yeah, okay, fine. It's already in the rearview mirror. what we find out then is that the attackers are weaponizing HR.
Yeah.
They're actually saying, hey, we're going to find ways to get around that. I was listening to a presentation yesterday. I was playing it at 2X, which I can do if there's a good presenter. And it was talking about how they had found a laptop farm, and one of the company found this is one of our laptops, and it was hired by a guy who turned out to be from North Korea, and they were using it, and they were using something interesting. They were actually communicating to other devices using ARP, mm-hmm. and they were sticking a little stuff there, a layer two protocol. It's like, wow, that's pretty clever that you can move laterally just by embedding something, and like, who's going to look for that? But we find out that once you're in, you tend to be in. And there's your other attacks, such as, can I get in through Wi-Fi and the neighboring Wi-Fi? Because if I can hack your next door neighbor, get into his Wi-Fi, and then go ahead and get a wired link and then change the configuration and hop onto that and try brute force. There's all kinds of attacks that are out there. So we can't really think of ourselves as being secure. Hey, I'm done. I can sit back. I patched all my balls. Life is good.
Oh, now
we go ahead and
touch. I can attest, a lot of different attack vectors. And I think generally, too, I think, like, the stories that can sensationalize, you know, are the extreme. Like, most reporters want to talk about a zero day that some APT just developed, right?
It's the best story.
And that's
right.
But like, the reality is, like, the threat actors are picking up Metasploit and using whatever's available if they're going to hit wide from a target perspective. And to deploy some ransomware. So I think, you know, whatever tool.
By the way, how to just criminals use Metasploit? The vast majority of Metasploit users are law-abiding Americans.
Correct. Agree. I was talking about what I see in the logs, right? When it's like, what tools give me use? It's.
Can I take your SE just for one second? Available. I wish attackers would use Metasploit exclusively, because we know how the Metasploit works. It comes with signatures. Attackers, go somewhere else. This is just for defenders. Everything in Metasploit is fingerprintable for sure. We did a good job with Shikadagani and like obfuscating shellcode, but like it is easy to write filters for that, turns out. So like if we are able to lead attackers by the nose by public working proof of concept through things like Metasploit and now Nuclei templates, the world is a much better place. We update, you've got built-in TTPs, built-in indicators of compromise.
I think generally, Todd, like they're going to use any tool that they have that anyone has access to. Like their number one tool typically when we're talking about the larger ransomware groups is ZoomInfo to search for what their targets are.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, that's the same
as Alan Bradstreet. Or,
And so it's I think that's one of the realities is that they're going to use opportunistically whatever they can get access to and whatever is going to be easiest to accomplish what their goals are.
And which are competitors that don't use marketing intelligence tools are missing out in their target.
Yeah.
Are absolutely. Like, talk to your marketing friends. Talk to your guy who does your SEO, your search engine optimization, and you will learn amazing tricks of how to target web applications.
Great. So weaponizing your SEO for fun and profit, it'll be your next DEF CON talk.
Hey, I did run marketing before, Todd.
Oh, yeah. In and out of marketing organizations for the last 10 years. It's awesome.
Yeah, you learn a lot there. Yeah.
So
you translate about skill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's think about it. We've talked about vulnerabilities, talked about exploits, we talked about attribution, difficulty of doing so. So a lot of the folks that are listening to CISO or watching CISO Tradecraft are either CISOs, VPs, working their way up in that chain. So more than just a technical skill, what communication skills do you think are valuable to help get executive attention onto the target so they understand the problem and then they can resource it effectively, so that you can go ahead and at least have a chance to defend your enterprise? Any insights on that?
I spend so much time and energy trying to educate people on like, what is the reality on the ground and how can I say something in a provable way? And I think Patrick does the same thing. When it comes to talking about vulnerabilities and exposures and misconfigurations, being able to be sober about it and not just like, not drinking, but like being sober and serious. I am a little jokey. I would say Patrick is a little jokey. But when it, and that's can be useful, right, for attention getting, like, hey, I'm going to open with a joke and now I'm going to tell you how much your enterprise sets. Like, that is a technique, right? But you don't have to be funny to do it. And I do think that, like, if you're going to say, like, you want to avoid at all costs being the Chicken Little, right? You don't want to be like, oh, we have to do this right now or else we're done. Like, or else we are out of business. Like, is that actually true? I mean, probably not. Like, you probably have business insurance. You probably have back.
Yeah, most people.
Now, but sometimes it is true. And you want to make sure that you are being judicious about it, right? Like, reserve your big guns for the thing that is a real thing. And if you look at any list of vulnerabilities, you're going to find a list of 10,000 vulnerabilities that are all CVSS critical, right? Is that a useful list? Like, 10,000 is like a tractable number for computers. Humans kind of top out at about 40 of counting A. And so if you can keep like under 40, like, you're in good shape. And so, like, and the whole trick there is prioritization, having like a stated, you know, set of criteria, like doing real science, right? And like blending your like science and engineering background with your marketing skills and your technical acumen. So you can say, like, actually, this is a reflective cross-site scripting. In this particular case, it was super bad, but like, generally speaking, reflective XSS is not that big of a deal. We can usually delay, but this is why this one is different, right? Like, that's the kind of conversation you want to have with your leadership.
That's a very good point.
Adding, like, the other thing I think is just starting with, hey, the reality of what the biggest threat is to most of these organizations. And I think, generally speaking, probably the biggest risk is ransomware, like shutdown of operations.
Hard theory.
You disagree.
I do.
What's your biggest risk? I say ransomware, right? Because, like, two things. We see it continually. The examples are in the news. A lot of organizations getting hit. But generally, like, we see shutdown operations. Like, you can't operate your business. And to me, that's like the biggest risk is if to a business owner is I have operational downtime. And I think going through several incidents in the past, what I saw was, yeah, downtime was the biggest issue from an organizational business perspective that costs you real money.
Sure. Sure, absolutely.
So to me, it's like ransomware is going to hit any and every organization, depending on who is on the other side of it. And so, like, being able to describe and share that from a risk perspective and then saying, hey, what actions are we going to take to move across and prevent this from happening?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think starting with real world examples really, really helps is what I'm trying to say there. But I want to hear, Todd, why you hard disagree, because that will be, how about when you hard disagree with me?
I believe in my heart of hearts that ransomware as a problem is vastly overstated by the cybersecurity industry. And they do it because ransomware is the easy thing to do. They do it because, like, ransomware is big and obvious. And it's easy to write about, and it's easy for journalists, it's easy for executives to talk about. It's like, Patrick just did it, and it's great, and it's not wrong.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you on all your points here.
Hang on.
What I'm talking about is from a justification perspective.
Ransomware is such a, like, it is the thing that you buy a security product to prevent. And it becomes this kind of thing where, like, I have this product and it's protecting me from ransomware right up until the moment it doesn't. and now I'm falling back on my business insurance or even my cyber insurance. Right. And I just feel like ransomware because ransomware is like an endpoint, right? It's a tactic. It's divorced from vulnerabilities, and it's divorced even from exploits. It's the thing you do once you already have control. Like, I know it's radical, but I want to, like, shift left, right? Like, I want to go further up the chain before the ransomware becomes the problem. Because if your value prop is like, I will stop you from getting ransomed, I will prevent you from getting ransomed for the next 2 years, right? Like, maybe that's my promise. cool. So every other kind of vulnerability and exploit is now like lower priority for whatever that product is, which means you're not going to tell me anything about like, well, who's profiling me? Who's actually exploiting my stuff and just sitting there, right? Because like we know about long dwell times. We know about people that just merely are attacking your, you know, edge as if edge is a thing, in order to reflect out to somewhere else, right? We know that like, the more serious attacks is that downtime, but it doesn't come with the ransomware component. They just take it down, right? And so, and that's, now we start talking about critical infrastructure. And there are like 14 industries that are defined as critical infrastructure. It's kind of hard not to be critical infrastructure because our entire economy is built on just-in-time delivery of literally everything. And so any piece that goes out kills the thing, kills all of it. And so like I feel like the DOS without the ransom note is a much more serious threat, right? Because like that starts to look like weather, you know, like I can't pay off a hurricane to stop. Right. And so like when you start getting these things and like, I don't know, I just feel like ransomware is a very easy shorthand that we've all kind of optimized ourselves into. And it's getting harder and harder to talk about things like to even get attention on things that aren't actively being used to extort money from you.
Well, if you look at something like a NotPetya, if we remember that, initially when it came out, it kind of looked like ransomware.
It looked like NotPetya crammed out.
Like then we realized
that wasn't the goal, right? The goal of NotPetya was to pretend to be Petya for long enough that like people can fart around with it. And then meanwhile, Petya is like just like taking stuff offline.
And it's just taking stuff online. And it's just negotiating with
Ukrainian specifically.
Was targeted to Ukraine. Yeah. Or anybody who was dealing with Ukraine. I mean, you take a look at what Maersk had and things like that, and they got all of their domain controllers encrypted and things like that. And so, except for one, I think there was one that was in Africa that happened to be down because they had a local power failure. He's like, don't power it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they were able to get things back again.
All I'm saying is like, don't get too hung up on ransomware, because just know that like ransomware is like, I don't know, the seventh thing, the sevens in the chain.
Yeah. Right. No, I agree. I think when we're talking at a CISO level and we're talking, probably let, you know, you're going to have a bias towards critical infrastructure probably a little bit.
I do.
But, yeah. You know, when I look at most organizations and businesses, like most of the leaders aren't going to understand all the things that happen that go into getting to the point where ransomware is deployed. And I agree with you that the cyber industry has largely pushed hard from a marketing perspective on buy this tool because it will prevent ransomware, which is like terrible. And so I agree with you on that. My take is I think there's a lot of corporate examples, many now, of ransomware and organizations having huge impacts, you know, from downtime related to that. So it's a little bit more relatable from a business standpoint to be able to have that conversation and then pull back on, oh, and here's how these things typically happen. And we need to make sure we have these mitigating controls from a tactic perspective. And so, yeah, I think I agree with you. Yeah. I was more thinking from like a CISO level of like, how do you,
so what you're saying is like, yes, I win the debate
in a way. Sure. I'm cool with,
you're cool with the, you're the, yes.
Yeah, I'm always here to learn. And so I think, yeah, I value your perspective. You're always right.
Patrick, I always value your perspective. I am mostly right. Don't we mostly?
Love it. Okay, we got this mutual admiration society going on right now. So let's move up in the last couple minutes that we have for the call about actionable steps that CISOs and other security executives can take. Now, I will agree with both of you from this perspective of this. Ransomware gives you an understandable message you could take to the executives or the people who control the budget to be able to translate, you know, who needs about this and what, okay, forget all about stuff. You don't want this to happen. It can either, A, it could stop your business from operating until we pay a ransom, or as you say, you can't pay off a hurricane, or the operational impact, that's bad because not you can't pay anybody, it's just gone. And if you don't have the good backups, you don't have the robustness to go ahead and protect your enterprise. And so what we say here is that security is in the business of revenue protection. It's a different mindset. We're not a cost center. We're not the cheapest toilet paper you can buy. The idea is that if you do security correctly, your business processes will continue with the minimal amount of interruption and impact that could reduce profitability, reduce operational effectiveness, and ultimately reduce employment because you have to lay everybody off because you're not making any money. So if we recast security from that perspective, is to say this is enabling the business, how do we then translate our knowledge of vulns, exploits, defenses, stuff like that, into that language so that we could communicate it effectively and respond appropriately?
Well, I think, I'm going to answer first on this one. But like, I think the problem that you're talking about earlier, Todd, is that people take that message and then they translate it to we need this product. And that's the biggest problem I think most CISOs or directors of security or people in security make is like they try and decide on a product when they have a problem where they should actually map like, oh, ransomware is a big concern to us. There's these 15 other tactics that happen before ransomware gets deployed. And what things can we put in place to mitigate these things? Maybe with even tools you already own.
Right.
Because you probably have a tool that might actually solve that problem. But I think generally a lot of organizations, have gone down the path of, I have this problem. I want to buy a product to solve for that. And so I think intimately taking the time to map out and understand, like, there's a reason why their security frameworks, they're not perfect. Understanding maybe some of the techniques from a threat actor perspective and how they're getting to that point of deploying ransomware or shutting off services or whatever the end state is. And that's why we have like things like MITRE ATT&CK framework, which is overly complex. I don't think that's like necessarily the easiest way for us to
wait. MITRE, did MITRE release something that was overly complex?
How translate? but generally there's a lot of information that you could pull from to say, hey, these are common tactics, right? So we need these types of mitigating controls. And I think if you take more of that approach, like you're probably going to be more successful and, oh, hey, phishing and credential compromise continues to just be like through the roof. Maybe you should put MFA on your VPN. It's 2025.
It's later than you think.
That's from my perspective, like how you're going to move the needle. So
tell me this.
Sorry, what do you got?
Really got
or discount.
Big ups on the, you can't just tool your way out of these problems. You do need people, like human people, that do have expertise.
AI isn't just going to do all this.
Stop. I'm trying not to talk about that thing at all. I know about Rocco's Basilisk. Do you? You should look it up. Ha ha ha. Now you're doomed. I would say that you do need human people in your organization, and that is easier said than done. We talk a lot about a skill gap in security, and then we also simultaneously talk about reductions in force in security, like all of the time. It's like, I don't know how these two things can both be true at the same time. And the reason why they're both true at the same time is because we pretend that we can't hire good security people because we set the bar way too high, I think. Like you have to, have 20 years of experience with the Linux kernel and, work a disassembler and, you think you know everything about security? Tell me your top 30 CWE IDs, right? Like it's nonsense like that, right? You can hire and train people who will be excellent security people, right? Like at a lower level. And the key is hiring for diversity, hiring for equality, and hiring for inclusion, right? Like make your HR the part, like you can hack your own HR and get better candidates, right? And get qualified candidates that you would otherwise not see. So that's the one. Two, you want to maintain this workforce. You don't want to be the subject of the riff. And to do that, you have to celebrate your wins in a big, obvious way, right? Security does its job best when no one notices. And that's why they get on the chopping block first. Because it's like, oh, well, we haven't been hacked in 5 years. Why do we have a staff of
of 5 when we can dump that down to 1, buy one tool from Patrick, and then buy this AI thing from other things. And that's like a whole team right there. And add it half the cost. Sure. Also, you're going to get owned.
Until everything goes sideways. So it's like the guy falling off the roof. 50th floor.
So our good CISO will both have a broad hiring base to train up new security people who will be the DEF CON superstars in 5 years, right? Like that's the investment. And then retain them by letting everyone know when they do good, right? And that doesn't mean like you need to have you don't need to like talk about like that time that you fought a hacker in the alley or whatever. Like you can talk about it's like, hey, we introduced the security control and the users didn't hate it. And it was invisible and we did feedback and we asked people like, hey, did you notice a month ago when like we installed this thing that, you know, just kind of quietly kept track of this thing? No, you didn't notice? Weird. Awesome. I did my job. Like you can do that after the fact. And so like having that kind of, it takes measurement. It takes actually looking and setting your criteria and like doing all your normal science, right? But then like reporting out on that routinely to say like, hey, we have been saving your bacon every day and you haven't noticed, and that's okay because that's our job, but also that's our job. And so I would like to continue doing that job, please and thank you,
and keep it around. Okay, well we've run out of time. I have a hunch we could keep going for another hour and be fascinating, but I got to respect the fact that other people like got to finish up and get back to work. So Patrick, Todd, this has been awesome. I appreciate it for being part of CISO Tradecraft and talking about vulnerabilities, exploits, attributions, things you can do and stuff like that. For those who are listening or watching, if you like this show, let us know. Give us a little thumbs up or give us some feedback. We can do more things like this where we kind of get everybody around. Yay. We'll put some stuff in the show notes that we've got here that we've come up here during the dialogue like that. If you're not following CISO Tradecraft, please make sure you do so. And don't forget to just follow us on your podcast channel, but follow us on LinkedIn. We got a whole lot more information than just podcasts. We also have a Substack newsletter. We put out little short videos and things like that to help you on your career journey. So until next time, this is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thanks for listening and stay safe out there.